and welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. We're a little bit lonely here in the studio today. It's just Peter and myself. Ben was not available, and we have no guest today, but we'll hopefully have just as exciting an episode as we otherwise would have. Today we're going to be considering some lobsters, and we'll get a little bit more into what we mean by that later, but we'll be looking at an essay by David Foster Wallace entitled Consider the Lobster, and unpacking a little bit maybe what some applications or some insights it might contain for us today. As we get ready to make our way back into the school year then, too, we'll also be talking a little bit about how we're wrapping up our summer, what we'll be working on or studying as the new semester approaches for us and for our children, and maybe a little bit of what my class load will be and some things I'm looking forward to talking about down the road. But we're not going to try to string this one out for you, so I could easily go on for 10 or 15 minutes now, but I think I will let Peter say hello and bring us our disclaimer.
Thank you, Wade. Yeah, and just a quick reminder to subscribe, rate, review if you are enjoying the podcast. And, you know, even if you're not, you know, just give us a download and we say thank you. But also share with your friends and family. It's the best way that we're able to get out there and get into more earbuds and on more car stereos. So with that, the disclaimer, and we'll get into our scripture narrative. This show does not speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us. We will be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy bit of skepticism. Because, well, as responsible resident of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you are just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live freely, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
Brings us to our scripture narrative for the day, which is just one verse. Once again, we're going to turn to an epistle, something we've not done a lot of so far. And just by way of context or explanation for what I will be doing, today we're going to be getting into a topic that Peter and I are interested in, one that I teach and that Peter has taught before as well, and one that we're hoping you are interested in as well. We'll be digging into philosophy, specifically into ethics and talking about virtue and what it is to ask ethical questions, things of this nature. And so with that in mind, I just, for our scripture today, wanted to begin from the Christian perspective with what is kind of the foundation, the operating principle behind any Christian ethic, especially a Lutheran Christian ethic. And one thing I emphasize in class as we get started or when I present on things, and I'm sure Peter does as well, is that justification, that we are declared righteous before God for Christ's sake through the gift of faith, justification is the presupposition for ethics. So as we'll be getting into our life together and our life with our neighbor and how we can serve Christ and our neighbor in Christ and through the obedience of faith, I just want us to understand that we're doing so in freedom. As Luther said, we are the free Lord of all, subject to none, but we are now also the free servant of all, subject to all. And so Paul teases this out in Galatians. He spends four chapters on this distinction between law and gospel and justification by grace through faith in Christ alone, and then transitions into chapter 5, where he talks about how we now live as those who are baptized, who are justified, who are righteous. And he begins there with an important reminder. He had told this story of Sarah and Hagar from the Old Testament and how Isaac is the child of the free woman. He is the child of promise that God had promised to send. And he then says this. He says, "For freedom Christ has set us free. Stand firm, therefore, and do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." And so we'll be talking about, as those who now have been so loved by God, as those who are now alive in Christ, who died to put our death to death, on the cross and then rose for our justification, our innocence, our proper standing before God through faith, how we now will approach life, what questions we might ask as we strive to serve our neighbor, as Dr. Berg said the other day, as mass of God, as God hidden in us serves those around us through us. And so we remember, as we get into all of this, we are not talking about what we will do to be saved, but how we may now live as those who are saved. As we're reminded by the scriptures, now that we are brought to life, we are living, we are breathing. And so just as a good fruit brings forth good fruit, so also now Christ is at work through us. And so it's with that joy, the joy of the justified, that we'll be discussing lobsters and whatever else might come up in what comes later. And with that, I will let us make our way to the free-for-all.
And we're back with the free-for-all, where we wrestle with pressing questions of life and try to answer them once and for all. As we're coming into the new school year here, and since Wade is still an educator and I recently was one, we thought, why not do a quick episode about going back to school? I believe we did briefly, I don't know if we did it as a free-for-all or as a wing in it, but there was a, you know, kind of end of school year, beginning of summer sort of talk. So thought, well, let's try this out again and go the opposite direction as we're heading back in. Life is a cycle and we're circling back around. So Wade, what do you have to say about going back to school?
Well, we have one of our children already back in school. Our oldest, Magdalene, is already back in high school. She began this week and she actually seemed pretty happy every day that I picked her up from school, so I take that as a good sign.
Is that a change from in the past?
No, you know, she's oftentimes happy. She enjoys her high school, but it was just good that
is it mostly
at the
because
start,
it's time away from dad?
That could well be, and then me picking her up is time with dad. But I do think for it being the start of the year, it's an especially good sign when a kid isn't complaining too much when you pick them up. I think my others start Wednesday of this week, if I remember correctly. So Sophie, Anna, Ziggy, and then Nick will be in his last year of middle school. That's all together at St. John's, but we'll be beginning, I think, on Wednesday, which means we're officially back to me being the bus driver and mom being the bus driver as we make our way around. School for the college will be beginning the week after this one, but this week, I don't mean this complaining. This is meeting week, and so my week is just full of meetings, and so you can only imagine the joy and expectation that's in my heart. What about your kids, Peter?
Well, Edith, our third, is starting school this year. She'll be in preschool.
I wish four. I could go just to watch this.
I'll tell a story about that in a minute. So she's starting, and the other girls are switching schools. I'm not teaching anymore, since I'm not teaching at the school where they were going, it was a good time to switch, and so we're changing them out. And both the girls are very excited about their new school. Not that they dislike their old school; they loved it very much, actually. But in fact, just last night, our neighbor to the back of us, her name's Betty. She's an elderly lady. She and her husband must be in their late 70s, maybe early 80s, but just wonderful people. And we see Betty out in the backyard. Her husband doesn't get out very much. And so the girls love running back there and talking to her. She calls herself Backyard Betty, actually. So I see her through the window.
Sounds like a biker.
Yeah, she's much, much kinder than most bikers I know. But no, I see her through the window, and I told the girls, go out and clean up the yard toys, and you know, it's starting to get dark out. I say, oh, and Betty's out there. Miss Betty's out there. So they both run out there, and they just talked her ear off for, I bet, 10, 15 minutes just about school and school starting.
Nice.
And being so excited about it. And so I came out, and I finally said, I feel like I need to save you right now so you can go in. And she said, oh, no, this is wonderful. She said, they're very excited to go back to school. And that's generally, maybe it's just because of their ages, but that's generally been the experience at the Hermanson household with back to school for the kids.
Now, is Edie excited for this?
Oh, yeah, she is. Her teacher came to do an in-home visit just this last week, and she was, you know, over the moon. dragging her all around the house, showing her everything from the bathroom, important things.
Now, when she's meeting her at the school, do you think there will be tears when you guys leave, or will it be kind of just like, okay, bye-bye?
I don't think any of our kids have ever cried when we left them. They're all very outgoing socially and just kind of eager for us to get out of the way. Edith, actually, when we went to go pick up books from school earlier in the summer, one of her classmates, her future classmates, was there with his mom. And she played shy. Now, you know Edith. She's not shy.
Right, right.
But she plays shy. And for about a week afterwards, she kept telling me, I don't want to go to school. Now, all of this with a smirk on her face. But I don't want to go to school because I'm shy to my classmates. I'm shy. And so, yeah, I think that that'll last for about 5 seconds. And then she'll try to be, you know, directing traffic or whatever.
I can only imagine. Is you have any special plans this summer? I know you've been working yourself on advancing yourself technologically, yeah. If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so I taught last year, and I'm not going to be teaching this year. I'm working in IT, actually, and I'm taking some classes in computer science, and so with the goal of in a few years being transitioned into a different career entirely. So it makes for an interesting time of the year for me, because normally right now I'm just rushing around worrying about how I'm going to even have something to say the first day of school, thinking, how did this come so quickly? What happened to the summer? But at the same time, you know, I don't know, maybe it's different for you, Wade, but the beginning of a school year or a semester, you get your new students, your new classes, and there's nothing but optimism. You look up and you're like, oh man, I'm going to mold this clay. These kids are going to be, you know, they're going to be, you know, just blown away by the things we're going to talk about. By the end of the semester, the school year, you have usually singing a different song, but yeah, so this is the time of the year where everything just looks beautiful. Everything's wonderful. And, I had the privilege of sitting down with the teachers that are going to be taking over my classes and just talk them through my notes and say, well, this is what I tried to do and go through that. And I came home from both those meetings and said to my wife, yeah, I miss this. I want to go teach these classes now. So being at this point right now, maybe this is a good thing. If I never teach again, that I'll always remember
positive
this
memories.
In a positive way.
Yeah, I actually have been plotting how to ruin the optimism right away. You know, it always drives me nuts that some professors go in and they say, you know, today everyone has an A. You know, what are you going to do with it? And I always go in and say, you're all failing. You all have a zero. You know, Jesus is all about gifts of grace, but now we're in the realm of the law. And so you're going to have to earn these points. So if you're wondering, you all have a zero. You have an F. And you better get serious right away. And so I try to come right away with pessimism, I guess. You know, it needs to get better. You're in big trouble here. You're already over your heads, and we haven't even had a lecture or a quiz yet. But I am excited for the classes I'll be teaching. I have the honors course on Renaissance and Reformation, which is always one of my favorite classes. A good group of students, a lot of reading that they actually do and then discuss. Renaissance.
I should just say a word to any college or even high school or middle school listeners out there. If you're not doing the reading that's assigned for class, you're robbing yourself. Especially college students, you're paying tuition for this. Yep. Stop paying tuition and going to these classes if you're not doing the reading. And you know, I was guilty of that myself. But you get you get to a point you realize you don't. There are a few times in your life where you will have the opportunity to read these things that are, you know, these really great texts, and your professors are doing so much of the hard work for you. They're picking them out, and then they even lead you through them. So do your reading.
Yeah, and you're really robbing your classmates or even your friends of good discussion or conversation too. I know for me, at least, once I got to seminary and grad school, I don't know in my undergrad years that I maximized my the opportunities I had, but some of my most well-remembered or appreciated conversations sprung out of the classes that we were taking, sometimes different classes, and the things we were reading, and then the ideas that are bouncing out around in our heads.
Yeah, the best conversations when you're in college and graduate school, they're overflows from the class, right? I mean, those conversations just continue out. And if you're not getting that, you may be taking the wrong classes. Maybe you got to find something that's more interesting to you, because that's what college is all about.
And that's hopefully what's going to keep you wanting to be a learner when you're done.
Yep,
I know
amen.
The honor students, I love, they'll catch me walking around, or I'll catch them in the cafeteria talking about the things we're doing in class, and it's always a joy. I have a history of the Reformations. I've only taught that once, and so I'm kind of rebuilding that now, and I'm excited for that one because I taught Luther both semesters last year, and that's great. But now I'll get to dig a little bit more into some Calvin and Zwingli and Anabaptist and Loyola, not necessarily because I'm looking for theological direction, but to be reminded, you know, it sometimes is helpful to consider how the other Reformations developed and what their emphases were. I have ethics, then I'll be teaching again, and then intro to theology, which is freshman, so that's basically, for the most part, trying to scare them into adulthood. and I'm trying to remember what my other class is. I should really remember this. Ethics, honors, intro, history of the Reformations. And something else. I am teaching another course, which I'm not remembering.
Are you doing one section of ethics or two?
One section of ethics. Okay. I've got five courses. What am I teaching? Ethics, history of the Reformations. That's two. And then I'm teaching honors. And then I'm teaching, intro in Romans, which is the one I'm teaching for the first time, so I'm building. So I should really know that better. But between history of the Reformations, honors, and Romans, I'm really excited to be digging into some of my favorite stuff to dig into. And I have to admit, with Romans, it's been a lot of fun in the summer to be working back through that again, too. And I'm looking forward to, not the students, our students won't be digging into the Greek, but to be going through the Greek again as I prep for lessons and things of that nature. So I think it'll be a fun semester, and I'm guessing there might be just a few discussion points that make their way onto the podcast as we work through stuff. And maybe our listeners, if you have any questions or thoughts with anything that Peter and I have brought up, whether it be kind of what Peter is doing, working his way back through computer science and tech. We've done some Apple and Windows Android, stuff and Android stuff in the past, or the topics we've discussed, I'll be teaching, things of that nature. Really excited for that. The other thing we're excited about is to have the faculty back on campus, and that always helps us develop ideas, too, for things that we would like to talk about. So school has started, or starting, started for Maggie, starting for the rest of us. I'm excited to teach. I'm excited to be in the classroom. Not excited for meetings, and not excited for having to wake up at 6 a.m. or 6:30 a.m. every day. I'm not going to tell you when I wake up in the summer, but it is not 6 a.m. or 6:30.
Is it a.m.?
I'm not going to answer anything more detailed than I do wake up every day so far at some point. Anything else you got, Peter?
That's it for me. You know, like I said, circle of life. It's coming back around. We're entering back into the school year.
That's Lion King, isn't
it? Lion King, yeah. That's what I was thinking of.
What is that? Something Nakata or
Mufasa?
Isn't it like there's some song or some word for that?
Oh, yeah, Hakuna Matata.
Something like that. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. Well, I suppose with that, then, we will make our way into the main topic. Brings us to our main topic today, which is lobsters. I'm not sure how many of our listeners enjoy lobster. I'll admit, I think I've only had lobster once, if at all. A little bit leery of seafood, nothing against seafood. It's not moral qualms or anything personal. Just didn't grow up with a lot of it, and something's fishy about it.
Didn't have a lot of seafood in Detroit?
No, and not a big seafood place. My grandpa fished a lot, and I watched him clean the fish, which I think is part of why I'm not a big fish fan. But I have, when I went out to Washington with a roommate through college, took the train out there and met him. I think I mentioned before, the one roommate, there were two roommates I had that were from Washington, forgot me to pick me up, and I slept in an apple orchard with some migrant workers. But once I made my way to the roommate who was from Seattle, we actually did go over to the ocean, and he boiled, it wasn't a lobster, a crab, I think it was, yeah. He boiled a crab alive, and I remember I dipped that in butter
some
and ate
butter
that.
Sauce, yeah.
Yeah. So I can't speak exactly to lobster as food, although maybe Peter and I will have to go to Red Lobster sometime now to test out what we've learned from this essay.
I don't know. Yeah, after this, we might not go, or maybe we will. Maybe that's the question.
This is the big question that we'll have to, maybe we'll go but get salad.
There you go.
Or I don't know to what extent we'll be willing to participate in the whole process.
Maybe we'll go to protest.
Yeah, that could be too.
Everyone who hasn't read this article right now is wondering, like, what are they talking about?
which is, I think, what we're trying to do. So just briefly, the article is by David Foster Wallace. David Foster Wallace is one of my favorite authors when it comes to fiction or to some of his essays that he's written. He lived from 1962 to 2008, struggled with depression throughout his life, and actually took his life in 2008. And they had switched his meds for depression. He had been doing really well, and likely that contributed somewhat to his taking of his life. But he was a novelist, but especially known for a number of his essays. His novel, Infinite Jest, If You're Determined, you know, it's 1,000 or 1,200, 1,300 pages, and he loves footnotes. I mean, even in a novel, all sorts of footnotes, and the footnotes are worth reading. But it's, you know, it's not for the faint of heart, and there's going to be some themes in there that not everybody's going to be big on or all that interested in. He's definitely wrestling with human existence as it is. But I've gotten a lot out of reading him, Infinite Jest and his essays, and we'll be looking at one of his essays today. David Foster Wallace is, as best we know, if you were to ask me, was he a Christian, I would say, I don't know. He was interested in the faith. He joked, I think, that he had failed Catholic catechism twice. He has made his way through the catechetical courses or was interested in them. Not that he failed like he couldn't handle it academically, but just was working his way through it. I know he did often enjoy attending some churches around where he had lived and taught as well. And so definitely an interest in Christianity, but not what I would call a Christian author so far as content goes. But what we'll be looking at today isn't necessarily an explicitly Christian question, but it leads to some questions that Christians will want to ask, as we talked about, as they live out their life in this life for their neighbor, and just ethical questions that in general will come up. This is an essay that I use in my ethics course fairly early on, just to kind of maybe get students thinking about what we do in ethics, what are some of the questions we might ask, and it's actually done fairly well. We'll come back to it later, but Peter found a PDF file of it online that we'll also link up that we can share for those who would like to read the essay later. But that gives a little bit of background on David Foster Wallace. Both his parents were professors. Mom was an English professor. I believe the father was a philosophy professor. So he grew up thinking about language and philosophy, and himself was trained very well in both fields. He himself taught at several universities. And so his essays love to play on both of these things, on language and on philosophy.
Yeah, and I should say, though, that, you know, although he's a professor and an academic, this article or this essay that we're going to discuss was written for a popular audience. In fact, it was written for Gourmet magazine, I believe, right?
Yep.
So it's not written in a heady style. And when Wade says he likes his footnotes, that might mean, I haven't read a lot of David Foster Wallace, but that might mean that he likes his academic footnotes. But in this essay, he has 20 footnotes, I think I saw, and they're all pretty long, and they're all just explanatory. And if you go and read it, and I encourage you to do so, you need to read the footnotes as you go through, because you realize what he's doing in there. Sometimes he says certain things, and then his footnote's kind of an aside, and you realize there's a little bit of a wink in there, you know, a sly smile that he's got going. So don't miss out on the footnotes.
And in almost all of his works, the footnotes are not academic necessarily. He was capable of doing academic work, but he's largely writing for a general audience. And even in his novel, the footnotes, part of the fun of them is he's giving details of the story that you wouldn't otherwise know. So, for instance, in Infinite Jest, if you could read the footnote on page 4, or you could wait 300 pages to figure out exactly what the acronym he was using meant. And so I agree with Peter, the footnotes do add a lot of clarification to the essay. Some may also be familiar with David Foster Wallace for a commencement address that he gave that floats around on YouTube. I believe it was at Oberlin College, and I believe he was invited to kind of talk about the value of liberal arts education. In a commencement address, I get it's maybe been a little bit played out. A lot of people have made a lot of it. But it's also something that I've found very helpful for using with students, even from a vocational perspective. Maybe not, he's not necessarily espousing the pure biblical teaching on vocation, but he's clearly hitting on themes that Christians would agree with on vocation. You can find that text and you can find the video. The video oftentimes is just a picture of him. I don't think there's live video of it that floats around on YouTube. But I believe it's called This Is Water. And I've found that to be very beneficial as well. So that might be something you might be interested in. I think there is one bad word in it. So you might want to earmuff yourself at one point. I can't remember what word or how far in. But otherwise, I think a helpful, definitely one of the better commencement addresses I've heard, because it's not all fluff and you're going to cure cancer and change the world.
Yeah, I'll try to get that linked up on the show notes pages. So if we can find it, it'll be there. And I believe this is episode 22. So letthebirdfly.com/22 will take you to our show notes pages. So that's where you can find the links to, you know, anything that we feel like linking to in this episode.
Well, excellent. Well, with that, giving a little bit of the background, Peter, I will. You want to talk maybe about the lobster aspect of it, and then get into some of what you thought were some of the big takeaways.
Yeah. So this is the first time I've read this essay, what was interesting is, like I said, it was written for Gourmet magazine, and he's writing so to a popular audience, and he's going to the Maine Lobster Festival, and I think it was in 2003.
This is Maine, like the state, not like the Maine lobster.
Not the full, Maine, like the yes, big one. Maine with an E on the end. Yes, the state. He talks about how popular this is, and so he's going through and kind of he's, I'm assuming, had been, you know, assigned to write an essay about it, so that he, you know, he's going to kind of review it, to talk about it. It's supposed to be kind of a fluff piece, and it is. I mean, as you start out, if you read this, you're like, is this the right article? I don't know if I'm reading the right article, except for that it's about lobsters. And you start reading it, and then you get, I don't know, two and a half pages into a 7.5-page essay, at least the PDF that I have, and all of a sudden it really changes tone, and you realize this isn't just about the Maine Lobster Festival. This is about ethics. This is about what it means to be human and what our responsibilities are as a human.
And this is and Wallace just loves to do this with stuff. To kind of draw you into a big question, I would say in those first three pages, Peter, if you're like me, you probably thought you learned more about lobsters than you ever possibly could have imagined you would know.
Yeah, no, and it was and to the point where it's kind of like, well, this is all mildly interesting, but you know, why am I reading this?
And he gets into, you know, that they're technically they're like insect-like, or they used to be called bugs, and actually they used to be considered in the past food for the poor because you could just walk out and apparently grab them. There were so many.
Yeah, even
in
goes
the Atlantic.
In the etymology of lobster possibly comes from an old English term, which was a misunderstanding of the Latin word for locust. And and then they mixed that with bug or with
something like that.
And so it's like that's where you get this this connection. Yeah. So he goes a deep dive into a minutia of different areas of lobsterness.
And just to give how taste and culture can change, he even gets into it. Some states or cities, prisons had laws against serving the prisoners lobster because it was considered like serving them rats. And so next time you do go to Red Lobster, if you do end up going after we've talked about this, just imagine that you are paying however much Red Lobster costs for food that they used to think was beneath prisoners.
Yes. No, another thing he says he's giving the review of the festival, and so this is one of the great lines in here, and there's tons of it. He's such a great writer. It's even if you don't appreciate the article for what it says, you'll appreciate the writing of it, the beauty of the words. And yes, words can have beauty. Everything doesn't have to be a microwave instruction manual when you write it. So,
and I'm going to interrupt. There's another great essay in the now if you get the book Consider the Lobster, which has a bunch of his essays. I will warn, there's a couple essays I'm not necessarily comfortable with, and I wouldn't recommend. Simply because he gets into some themes or topics that maybe aren't for everybody and certainly might not be for the Christian, and I definitely wouldn't have my students read. But one he has in there that is helpful and gets on language is Authority in American Usage. So I'll have to maybe pass that on to you to see if you enjoy that one at some point.
I mean, just from, you know, his command of the language, I can tell he's thought a lot about this. So. Yeah, so he writes in his, you know, he's doing a review again of the Maine Lobster Festival, and this is what he says. He says, what the Maine Lobster Festival really is a medieval county fair with a culinary hook, and in this respect, it is not unlike Tidewater Crab Festivals. Midwest corn festivals, some of us might be more familiar with those, or Texas chili festivals, etc., and shares with these venues the core paradox of a teeming commercial demotic events. It's not for everyone.
Yeah, and right? I love how he even adds in there, he's into the detail of there's not enough napkins for if you want, for such a messy food and the bathrooms aren't clean and all this. But he draws you in with just wonderful turns of phrases like that. You really are thinking this is simply going to be about should you visit and is the food good and entertainment, things of that nature. Sorry, Peter, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and then shortly after that he says these sort of anthropods grow by molting. So he's talking about how crabs shed their shells. Rather the way people have to buy bigger clothes as they age and gain weight, which I thought that's accurate.
That hurt my feelings, though, because I actually have to go clothes shopping for school, and I'm afraid to find out what fits and what doesn't now. So
this goes back to your skinny jeans in Europe when you were over there?
Yes. The you asked me, Peter, a little bit before we got on the air, and so I don't want to go into my thought first because this is something students have heard me talk about, but this is maybe something students will listen to when they find out we've done an episode about an essay they're doing.
They won't have to read then, right?
Yeah, we might be doing their work for them.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just make all this up and then I can tell which ones faked it.
Maybe we are. Maybe we are making this up and maybe we've already made everything up. And maybe this article doesn't exist and maybe you don't exist.
And you'll never get this time back. And is there any meaning to life? All right. Hopefully, we have the students nervous enough if they are trying to cheat. Peter, if you were going to think of one, the first thing that comes to mind, a big question with respect to this article, I think the details of what his concern is with the lobsters will come out as we address these things. But what seems to be for you, you mentioned he gets it very serious all of a sudden. What's one of the big issues he has or that leads to a big question for him regarding lobsters?
Yeah, so he's I highlighted the place where I felt like the whole article turned or changed tone, and it was, wow, on my page it's 3.5, on my PDF it's 3.5 pages in, like I said, a 7.5 page article, and this turn comes. But he says, is it at all right to boil a sentient creature alive just for our gustatory pleasure? A related set of concerns is the previous question irksomely PC or sentimental. What does all right even mean in this context? Is it all just a matter of individual choice? And those questions, as soon as he got there, I was, okay, I get it now. I get where we're going because, as a trained philosopher, these are the questions that you're constantly asking, and this is why I understood right away why Wade was having his classes read this for ethics, because it forces you on this kind of mundane, topic, the Maine lobster festival and just eating lobster in general, right? Are lobsters, food for royalty or food for peasants? Where does the word lobster come from? All these questions. Now you're forced to the questions that are kind of always right in front of you. Is this okay? And now you're asking these bigger questions and you're asking these questions that drive to the heart of what does it mean to be human? Now, I'm not saying that a lobster's human, not by any stretch.
Oh, I'm saying that, though.
But, well, that's fine. I'm not. But as humans, we have to contend with the fact that the lobster's in front of us. This is, these are the sorts of questions that I find just endlessly fascinating and can't understand why some people, find them, I don't even want to say boring. It's almost more, there's more of an indifference to it than just boredom.
I think it's probably because they just want to enjoy their lobster. But but Peter kind of hit on there, I think, an important point, is that this is one of the few things we eat that we kill, we boil alive, right? And so you go to this festival or you go to Red Lobster's never going to sponsor us now.
We just lost another sponsorship.
Yeah, your food is being boiled live. A cook is doing that for you. But it's one that some people, the very immoral ones of you out there, I'm just joking, that some people even becomes intimate enough they do it in their own home, right? That you take the lobster, you pick it out at the store, whatever the store may be, and then you take it home and you boil it alive. And so a line that he has in there, I think Peter got to, I think as far as if there is a main thesis point, the main thesis point, but to give a point of comparison, he has the line on, it's page 247 in the book. I'm not sure where it is, what you have, Peter. But he says, try to imagine a Nebraska beef festival at which part of the festivities is watching trucks pull up and the live cattle getting driven down the ramp and slaughtered right there on the world's largest killing floor or something. There's no way. I think it would take a lot of therapists to deal with the trauma children would suffer if that did take place. Yet he's saying, as you noted, this is what's happening at this lobster festival. They're bringing the lobsters in right from the sea, and then everybody watches, and they boil them live.
Yep. Yeah, no, and, you know, it's interesting. This is the question of, you know, the food that we're eating is one of those that more and more the preparation of that food, especially the animal, the sentient food that so we have to kill it, that's become more and more removed. There was an interview that I heard with a lady from, I believe it was either Portland, Oregon or Seattle, Washington, out in that area, and she had started giving classes on butchering. And some people were really upset about this, and her whole thing was, you should know where your food's coming from. You should know this. And I just, it was interesting because some people were upset, like, how are you teaching, you know, why are you teaching people how to butcher animals? And her point was, well, if they're going to eat animals, they should know what they're doing. They should be kind of an eyes wide open sort of moment was what she was going for. And I just thought, yeah, that's kind of interesting because I grew up in a fairly rural area, and I'm trying to think. I don't know if I've ever seen anything get butchered, you know, actually live, but I've seen it, you know, seen it cut up and seen the slabs hanging there. And, you know, you can still tell what the animal is. Yeah. But when you get to lobsters, anyone who's had lobsters, especially if you've made it yourself, it's right there. There's no question. We don't, it's not cut up first. In fact, even when you're eating it, you're breaking the shells and sucking out the meat. And, you know, Wade doesn't like it. I think lobster is delicious, but.
The process to me just seems, like, I don't like having it crack something open or I like the to be already just there for me to put in my mouth.
It is a lot of work, but I see it as, you know, like I'm burning calories as I eat so I can eat more, sort of, you know, it's building on itself, you know.
And it is high in protein, we learned in the essay.
He does talk about that. There are other ways to get high protein food, though, we hear, too. So
I have heard that. That brings to mind, and this is just an example of why I don't get much done. I was supposed to be working on syllabi the other day. And at this point, if any of my bosses are listening, look, there's a deer outside. Go check that out. But I ended up, you know, as I'm wont to do, looking up something on YouTube because I do try to use some videos in class. But then I somehow found my way to Vice News, which I'll sometimes watch when they have interesting stories. And they had a story on a guy who eats roadkill. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. And it's an old guy from England or, you know, Britain, whatever. I don't remember. He's somewhere in the UK. And then he eats roadkill. I mean, this is the main point, is he eats roadkill. That's what I'm trying to get at. But they're asking him about eating roadkill. And, you know, has he ever purposefully run anything over? And he said, no, well, why would I do that? If there's enough food to, you know, if you're going to kill something, you should really, you know, have a use for it, a purpose for it, whatever the case may be. And so this is not a good guy to probably just be giving general life advice. But he got to, because, I mean, he did get to one point, too, that he basically said, you know, he'd maybe even try, like, cannibalism if the person was already dead or something. And that, I mean, this is not a dude I want to hang out with. But he did make the point of,
I don't know, but he's never doing the killing, right?
Well, and that's the thing, is that he's emphasizing. But, you know, that people will have animals killed, will have things killed, and then go and have two bites and think of all the food that we throw out. And he was talking about the disconnect then from having to butcher that thing or see its life taken, whatever the case may be, and then it just showing up on my plate where I don't even have to break it up or crunch anything. And I think there's something, too, when you think of maybe some who still do that today, or the interest some have in more organic food or being a part of where their food is coming from. But even I think if you just think of ancient religious practices, and Christian and non-Christian even, but even the sacrificial system, how attached you were to the butchering of the food that took place and recognizing that this was a gift of God. And, you know, with the sacrificial system, especially the life is in the blood and you drain the blood, recognizing what was taking place. And I do think that's something for me, whether I'm watching a video about a guy who eats roadkill or reading this, is that we are removed from that process. And so he makes the point, well, so there's two questions. A, why don't we think about it? And one possible answer is we don't want to. And then secondly, well, do we think about why we don't want to? And that, I don't want to ruin lobster for anybody, but I think Peter's better trained in philosophy to maybe be able to unpack a little bit here what Wallace is doing. That's actually, this is not just somebody who, you know, got a PETA flyer and is rethinking his life, but what he's trying to do here.
Yeah, no, and I'm trying to find the place right now. Let me see. It's towards the end here, about four paragraphs from the end of the essay. He says, "I'm not trying to give you a PETA-like screed here. At least I don't think so. I'm trying rather to work out and articulate some of the troubling questions that arise amid all the laughter and salutations. I've read that as salutations for, and community pride of the Maine Lobster Festival." And so he's really, I mean, like, I take him at his word. I don't think that in the way it reads, he's not giving you a screed, but he's really wrestling with these kind of deeper questions. And, you know, as he dives into the question of what does it mean to, you know, to boil a, you know, sentient creature alive and then eat it, you know, he asks things about questions about pain and suffering. And these are the questions that I find terribly fascinating. These are the questions that drove me to do philosophy in the first place. What does it mean to have pain? Well, we can take a very scientific approach to that and say, you know, it's the sensation of pain, sensation of displeasure. I don't even know how, you know, exactly how you'd want to define it. But the next question, the bigger question for me, is not just pain but suffering. What is suffering? Mm-hmm. And that's an emotional, that's a psychological. There's some other component there, and that is something there that we understand implicitly as humans. And then the question is, do animals understand that? And that's I don't know. For me, that's fascinating. Do they understand it? If they do,
and I've asked them, and they've
they
not
won't
answered
answer.
Yet.
I know. Well, or they're just stubborn about it. So, yeah. No, and I ask my kids too before they can talk. I'm kidding.
I do ask babies now. Ever since since Allie I brought up the eating of babies. I'm just joking. I don't eat babies.
No. One of the things he says, since pain is totally subjective and mental experience, we do not have direct access to anyone or anything's pain but our own. And this is one of the problems with in philosophy with trying to understand where, you know, how can we transfer this? Maybe some of our listeners maybe had that experience in high school, or if you're brighter than I am, maybe earlier, about realizing the colors that we see. How do we know that they're the same colors that someone else sees? How, when I say the sky is blue, of course, everyone says the sky is blue. They've been seeing the sky their whole life. But maybe the blue that they see is actually the green that I see, right? Or the red that I see. And these questions of subjectivity, when there's no way to kind of bridge that, that's what he's getting to here, is that someone
although
has...
Is it G.E. Moore who says yellow is yellow?
Yellow is yellow,
so
yeah.
Yellow has to be true.
Yellow is yellow.
For Moore.
The rest of the colors we're not sure about.
Right, because Moore says, "Why? The truth is like yellow. You just know it when you see it.
You know
it
when you see it, yeah.
So you're just ruining his whole system of thought.
I think G. Moore would be able to take me to task on these issues.
quite possibly, yeah.
So the other thing with pain, though, is, you know, another example that I thought of was when you're at the doctor's office and they say, "How bad is your pain?" And maybe they say, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10. Or my favorite is when they have the smiley faces, yeah, that go down to a frowny face. Where is your pain level on here? And we're trying to objectify something that is essentially, at its root, in its essence, subjective. And that's not to say that there isn't something objective that if we had that vantage point, we could see it, but we don't have that vantage point. We're always struggling we're grappling blindly for that vantage point. We might call this the divine vantage point, right? I mean, God knows, but we, you know, our reason takes us so far and falls short, you know?
And there's so many components when we're thinking about pain versus suffering. I can sometimes infinitely increase my suffering, even though my pain level doesn't increase, by what I then mentally, psychologically, attitudinally do in that respect. And this is something that can oftentimes happen. Everybody approaches things different. If I'm going to go to the doctor or have some procedure, that procedure is now 100 times worse than it's actually going to be in my mind, because I'm the kind of person who just expects it to be like basically the equivalent of in the Middle Ages when supposedly they'd drill a hole in your head and pour milk in there. Like, like this terrible thing is going to – and it might be I'm just getting a cavity filled. But I'm just picturing, you know, this – the worst possible thing, you know, like a cartoon giant drill or whatever the case may be. So there's aspects that come into that too of, well, what do we do with that? And I can't know if a lobster suffers, and I can't know the extent of its pain. But I think, and Peter's hit on a number of the ethical themes, where it can be helpful for us as we seek to live together, just as good citizens or as Christians, as also good neighbors in Christ, is to recognize how difficult it can be for me then to understand my neighbor's pain or suffering or where they're at. And also to maybe wonder, what questions haven't I asked about my neighbor that I should be asking? And I know Wallace gets on that when he gets to his commencement speech. And the part of the commencement speech that never sits well with me is about the person who gets angry in traffic, because I'm the person who gets angry in traffic, and I always feel that's completely justified. And he's kind of ruined road rage for me a little bit, because he says, well, what if that SUV or whatever in front of you is on, you know, I can't remember the scenario. Let's say, you know, my wife is pregnant, going to the hospital. I don't think that's a scenario, but, you know, they're rushing. They cut you off for some reason. Well, that takes levels of thinking or possibility or thought that I'm just in the moment not willing to take. That's the worst person in the world after Hitler. You know, I need to be somewhere. Why are they cutting me off?
At least you keep your standards right. So you have Hitler first.
Yeah, oh, Hitler's always number one. So. And I should probably put Stalin up there.
I don't know. Stalin gets a pass for some reason. No one ever thinks about
that. Because you couldn't get in and work in the archives for so long because of the Cold War.
Well, see, this is the historian. This is an historian talking.
Yeah. But there's been a lot of work now done trying to, you know, now that we know more. But
so maybe people will start appropriately hating Stalin. Is that what you're saying?
I don't. Yeah. I just think there's more people that are maybe. Okay. We're going to save. We'll wait till we get Dr. Badura on with politics and politics as religion before I upset people with what I was about to say.
Don't worry, though. He will upset you.
Yeah. But in what ways haven't I asked about my neighbor, and or in what ways haven't I considered what my neighbor might be going through, or even how my neighbor got to the thought my neighbor has? And that can be especially with students. And in Peter's taught ethics here before, I've revised my course last year, totally revised it. There were some weaknesses in how I had it going, just because I had inherited something and I needed to play to my strengths, so I had made some changes, and then you improve it. But I think for the students especially, as after this we're about to delve in this long string of just secular, if we can use that term, philosophers outside of St. Augustine, who's going to show up and say original sin, original sin, original sin, and Aquinas, who's going to, you know, try to make a... I like Aquinas, I'm not going to lie on some stuff, but they're going to have this large string of thinkers who they may or may not agree with. But to get them to ask, well, what might this person get you to ask that you never realized you should have asked? Or what might this person force you to ask that you've kept yourself from asking for fear of wrestling with it or with uncomfortability? And how often aren't the questions I'm afraid to ask of myself or about others rooted in, well, I don't want to have to give that thing up, or I don't want to have to do that work for my neighbor that I might not otherwise do if I'm not aware of their situation. Now, that's not gospel thinking, right? I don't want to have to serve my neighbor, so I'm not going to think about it. But the old man oftentimes will think precisely in that way. Even my kids, if they don't hear that their sister or brother's hungry, they can quickly eat their pizza so that they don't feel a compulsion to leave that piece had they known that that their sister or brother only had gotten one or something like that.
Yeah, no, and he and David Foster Wallace actually says at one point, this question that he's asking is not just complex, it's also uncomfortable. And that's where I thought, you know, this is how I saw the article really being driven by him, is that this is a discomfort that he identifies and that he then deals with and he wrestles with instead of brushes away. And in a previous episode, I don't know, it was one or two episodes ago, we talked about Aldous Huxley's A Brave New World. And the Soma in there. And the whole point of the Soma was to push away those discomforts. And as a person who wants to, you know, pursue the liberal arts, who wants to pursue, you know, their own humanity in a kind of a deeper way, I think that one of the things we have to do is identify those uncomfortable places and then deal with them and look them straight in the eye, not because we're going to have, you know, the final pat answer, like, oh, here it is. Oh, we're talking about, you know, eating animals. Everyone doesn't have to be a vegetarian. I know what the Bible says. God gave us creation for, you know, for our own, you know, use.
Isn't that even more reason to ask these questions?
Well, though, exactly. Right? Yeah. But that doesn't push the question away. It's just a pat answer.
Exactly. I'm agreeing. Yeah.
And this is the, you know, when we when we ask the question philosophically, what does it mean to be human? So no, this isn't religious necessarily, but it
or
fits
even
in.
Sometimes if we ask, are we human or are we dancers? Is that the song?
I don't
That's
know.
That's been going through my head ever since you said human the first time. I'm not a dancer. I'm human, but what is it to be human?
I don't have rhythm. Really?
I want to be a suburban rapper.
Yeah,
as came up in the previous episode, yeah. but I'm not going to do a lot of moves when I'm busting my rhymes. I'm going to just sit at a desk.
You could do like the drunk,
this is my
drunken,
only move.
Drunken lady.
Peter can describe what I'm doing right now, but this is my only.
His hands
my
up
only
in the
move.
Air.
This is what, like grade school dances.
From here
this
to
was
there.
The, yeah, I can put my hands in the air and. I don't even wave them like I just don't care. I wave them somewhat nervously. I do care.
Like you
I'm
care
concerned
too
how
much,
it looks. Yeah.
It really is unfortunate.
But I believe you were about to say, you know, basically lobsters and humans are the same.
Yeah, I think that. no, what it means to be human and that we have this rational capacity, you know. So Aristotle, one of his definitions of humans is risible animals, which risible means that you have the ability to laugh, of course, and I always think that's probably the best. Another one is featherless bipeds, so bipeds, two legs, featherless, so you're not a bird. But the one that he really hits on, and this is what he's driving towards, is a rational animal. We have reason. And if whether you accept that or not, and there are reasons to question that as a final answer in it, but it gets to a point, and it gets to the point where you're asking then, what is it, you know, we have reason, what does that mean? And that means we have to ask these questions when we get to these uncomfortable things. We don't just pop soma. We don't brush it away. We don't have a pat answer. We say, why is this uncomfortable for me? Let me address that. And, you know, oftentimes I don't necessarily change my mind. My position becomes more informed and maybe moderated, maybe even stronger than it was before, but it's more informed. I have a reason now behind it. And, you know, as Christians, to kind of turn on this point here, St. Peter says to us in, I believe it's his first yep. epistle, always be ready with a reason for the hope you have in you. I take this very seriously as a Christian. I say, if someone asks me, why are you a Christian? And, you know, going to graduate school and studying philosophy, you get these kind of questions. I'm ready with that answer. It may not be the best answer, and it's certainly an answer that continues to change. And right. and you
is
know,
the answer the parties?
Because my mom made me.
Yeah.
No, it's I give the trite answer that Rousseau gives in his book Emile. Have you read this?
Have no,
you read
I have
this?
Not.
So he, it's the Savoyard Vicar tells.
Rousseau? Was that the deep sea diver?
No.
Or was that? That was Jacques.
Jean
Castro?
I'm not
oh, kidding. It was the Cuban dictator.
Castro, yeah.
All right, so I'll stop.
No, he's but he is the vicar says to him. I think it's the vicar. Maybe the vicar's being told this, but he's doubting whether or not he should remain. You know, his religion, and the advice is go back to the religion of your fathers. It was a good religion, and you know, and if it's wrong, certainly a just God couldn't hold that against you because you didn't choose it, right? I just think no. So I mean, that makes it seem very easy, but You're kind of forced to choose. You're forced. You need to have that reason for that hope you have in you. And so when you come across these hard questions, like David Foster Wallace came across with the Lobster Festival, I would encourage you not to run away from it, but to address it. And that's especially if they're uncomfortable. That probably means there's something there that, you know, for one reason or another, you're trying to avoid. All the more reason to dive in.
And I think, you know, especially
dive in not to the boiling pot of water.
Right? No,
lobster.
Don't do that. That'll end poorly, as the lobsters learn. Especially in a day and age where there's probably more communication than ever before, but less meaningful discussion too. I think, I've been ready to get rid of my phone lately, just to get rid of it in general, just because texts and phone calls too. And people who know me know, like, don't call me on the phone unless you're dying, or someone we know is dying. Or, like, even if my house is on fire, just text me, honestly. Like, phone conversation's not my thing. I love conversation, but not
phone. This reminds
me,
I my New Year's resolution, I'm failing, but I mean to call you more often on the phone. And I think I've only called you once this year.
And that's how you get blocked on my phone. But I've been, you know, ready just to kind of get rid of it. And everything going on in the country, I think people more than ever want to make other people uncomfortable in their thoughts and their presuppositions and what they hold and value. But I think it's a real act of cowardice to want to do that when you're unwilling to be uncomfortable in your own, when you're unwilling to ask yourself where am I maybe unsure of myself, or what am I trying not to think about? What am I taking for granted? And so, you know, I oftentimes tell the students, you know, if David Foster Wallace were still alive and I got a chance to meet him, I'd probably ask him, so do you still eat lobster? And I think the answer would be yes, because he kind of gets at in the essay of, look, I have an interest in this. I like eating, right? But I do think, and this is something we like to do with the podcast, but just in general for ethics or philosophy or even theology, is, you know, where are our blind spots and how can we address them? And I think, as Peter said, what I've found in my own experience is I haven't found myself forsaking my faith or even many of my positions on a number of things, although some have changed, political positions, you know, shift to get more nuanced. At times, I think I've become much less hawkish when it comes to war and things of that nature over time, and maybe less hopeful that the government can just fix everything. I mean, I remember being in middle school and thinking, like, why doesn't Bill Clinton just end poverty? I think Clinton was president then, or in high school, you know, and you realize, well, he probably would have if he could have just clicked his fingers, you know, but these problems are more difficult. But at the same time, that we can also benefit from it. And that I'm talking here, this also applies simply in the Christian context. How can we think about being better able to explain our positions? How can we think about being better able to serve our neighbor? How can we better think about how to carry out the mission of the church well, which of course is preaching and teaching, but also then how can we also then the church be a blessing for our neighbor in other ways as well? Not that I'm espousing a social gospel here or anything like that, but I think an essay like this can be extremely valuable for us just to say, well, what have I not thought about? And I don't want everybody staring at their dinner after they listen to this, not enjoying their meal because now they're wondering, you know, do string beans feel pain or, you know, whatever the case may be. And I'll get off my bully pulpit, but I do think it's helpful for that.
Yeah, no, and I mean, certainly shouldn't look at that. In fact, David Foster Wallace says towards the end of the article, he says, you know, defending such a belief is difficult for him, like, is there such a position? He says, I have an obvious selfish interest in this belief since I like to eat certain kinds of animals and I want to be able to keep doing so. And B, I have not succeeded. And this is the one that I think, you know, for me is really kind of hits home. He says, I have not succeeded in working out any sort of personal ethical system in which the belief is truly defensible instead of just selfishly convenient. Selfishly convenient, that's how most ethical systems work. And I think that, you know, what I hope, you know, at least one or two of our listeners, well, that'll be all of them, but take away from the for the episode is that a lot of times we kind of mindlessly accept a position because it's comfortable. And we say, or as David Foster Wallace says, it's selfishly convenient. I want to believe this, right? Well, this is how I identify myself as a, you know, Republican or a Democrat. This is how I identify myself as a Christian or a Lutheran, or this is how I identify myself as a Wisconsinite
or
yes. Yeah. But we, all of these kind of shortcuts that we take then, instead of dealing with the uncomfortableness and really, you know, coming up against it. And, you know, as we talk about the one of the goals of the podcast, you know, this idea of living freely in a world given back to us. I think that's how we start, right?
Yep.
Okay. This is part of, you know, living freely is being free now to kind of to wrestle with these questions, not just having these kind of pat answers, but saying, no, I'm going to look deeper and try to understand better. Wade, you mentioned, you know, Aquinas and Augustine earlier, and these are, you know, Christian fathers that
Augustine
or Augustine, yeah, they took thinking very seriously, and they you know committed their lives to doing just that, and we're richer for it. They certainly, I would hope and assume that they were themselves, but we are. They actually have something more, you know, that they're even giving to us. But each of us has this, you know, opportunity, let's say, and I would just, you know, say these are the moments where we kind of confront these questions, that don't push them away. Sometimes let those questions in and wrestle with them, and, you know, not just when you're eating your string beans tonight.
The Peter brings up some stuff that reminds me of us talking before he came in, and we had got on I think I had said I had just listened on Audible to Ayn Rand's Anthem, which is a dystopian novel. And so Peter was, you know, espousing his anarcho-libertarian. I'm just joking. But we were kind of talking about, you know, how can Rand's view be reconciled with Christianity? Can a Christian hold it? And that's another episode, so we won't get much into it. But Rand closes the essay or the novel. The main character says, and you know, the most important word or the word we shall live by is ego. And this worker had just fled from and is now being liberated from this collectivist society. Rand has the Soviet Union and the Bolshevik Revolution in mind.
Yeah, that's where she comes from. So
yeah, and so. I joked with him because I said I was going to talk about freedom in the scripture narrative. I said, you know, and he said, freedom from or for what? And I said, freedom from neighbor, because Rand has the guy saying there that what is freedom if it's not freedom from my brother? And that's where, you know, the wonderful thing about what Christ does for us is that's a different freedom than what Christ is talking about when he comes. That's a freedom that ultimately still lives somewhat paralyzed by fear, right? This guy, at the end of the novel, and I won't ruin it, it's a quick listen on Audible, he is, you know, excited and motivated. Freedom is this very motivating thing. But at the same time, he's saying, oh, I got to electrify the boundaries of where I'm living now for if my enemies come, whatever the case may be. We're not, you know, Wallace talks about these things are uncomfortable, so we don't want to think about them. Christians of all people ought not be paralyzed by fear to think about these things, because we are a free people. We're free from sin, death, and the devil, and we're free for our neighbor, right? We're of all people, hopefully the best equipped to be able to step back and look at these things honestly and be willing to play them out and see how they fit or work. And to know what's that radical thing that Christ came and he said that turns all ethics on its head, and it's because he first did it for us. He says, love your enemies. And so maybe if you do go on and you read Consider the Lobster, you can substitute your enemy for that. Or maybe it's the neighbor in your life that it's really hard to serve, whether it be a spouse, a child, a roommate, a coworker, a student, a teacher, whatever the case may be. But we are free now. Why are we free to love even our enemies? Because we are the freest people of all. We have everything we need in Christ, and now we're free even to give the reason for the hope that we have and to think about it even and to analyze it. And I don't know if I just made any sense in there, Peter, but hopefully I was getting at something there.
No, I think so. I think we're kind of wrapping up here, and I just wanted to end, or at least close to the end here, with what how David Foster Wallace ends his essay. He says, it's probably best to stop the public discussion right here. There are limits to what even interested persons can ask of each other. And I feel like, you know, that's such a great ending. And again, another nugget, another reason to read this article. It's just beautifully written.
And I don't want this episode to come across as Peter and I, you know, sitting down together in the office and trying to hold forth that this is a particular virtue or capability we have beyond anyone else.
No, certainly not.
I do hope it came, and I don't think Wallace does that in his essay.
No, I don't think. Well, that's what I like about it so much is, you know, he talks. I mean, it really kind of, he spoke to the struggle, I thought.
Yeah.
Which is,
and I think that's, you know, why it resonates with me is because I can find so many areas in which I haven't done this. And I think when I talk about what this enables us to do, whether my students or whoever might be listening, this is something that at the end of the day, an essay that oftentimes leaves me keenly aware of how much I've failed to do it, but maybe sometimes also then opens possibilities for things that otherwise might not have been on my radar. So I do hope some will give it a read. The commencement address will also link on there. Once again, because I know there's some people who just look for reasons to get upset. We're not endorsing everything David Foster Wallace ever. We don't endorse everything Luther ever wrote.
We don't even endorse everything we say here. So
yeah, we don't endorse ourselves. But something that we had been talking about that we considered helpful, and this is the kind of thing sometimes maybe we're not so theology heavy, but things that maybe just are useful from people from a variety of backgrounds. to be thinking about. So that's, once again, David Foster Wallace, Consider the Lobster. Peter's going to link the PDF. I don't think there's any copyright issues with us doing that since it's already available online through an Ethics Institute, I believe.
Yep.
And so we'll get that up. If you have thoughts on it, questions, email us. What's the best email again, Peter?
Podcast at letthebirdfly.com or on our Facebook page, Just Let the Bird Fly, facebook.com/justletthebirdfly. You can find us on there. And that's where most of the conversation happens when it happens. But we always appreciate hearing from you any way you send it to us. You can also tweet at us and things of that nature.
And I'm trying to get – I keep going on Twitter and then I get scared away by all the nastiness. But I am trying to get better at that too. But as
your problem with Twitter is that you just don't have enough characters, right?
Yeah, well, that's the other challenge is people always say my emails or my texts are so long. But I do hope, hopefully with school picking up here too, I'm excited for some of the stuff I'm going to be teaching and doing, and I think it'll help bring some possible topics for us. I think Peter will have the same as he has children in new school. He's doing new work, whether that be main topics, free-for-all, scripture narratives as they come. But we're also still very interested in your ideas too, so please keep sharing them. It's going to be fantastic for me to see colleagues back on campus. I see some still here on the third floor, but to see the rest of them, just seeing them gives me ideas, listening to them, talking about what they're teaching or having conversations with them. I learned so much from them, and I think it'll be a number of ideas to come too. So we're excited about some of the stuff we're going to be doing coming forward. We have been extremely busy as a group, and I think August is just a busy month all around. We're hoping to get some more Winging It sessions up as we're going forward. But we hope you're enjoying. I forget to mention at the beginning of every episode, and Peter already did, but I'll bring it back to. Please do think about subscribing, rating, reviewing. These things do help get the word out. If you're enjoying the conversation, invite other people into it. If you think we're bringing something valuable, whether it's food for thought or just some of our convictions even, help us share that with others. So we really appreciate it. And with that, Peter, unless you have anything else, we'll maybe probably be ready to round it out. So as you remember now, justification is the presupposition of Christian ethics. As you now go forth as a baptized child of God, or as you go forth as someone who is not a Christian, not yet, maybe not interested at all, but want to be a good citizen, we pray that you find something valuable in David Foster Wallace's essay and our discussion of it as you do so. And in the meanwhile, as we strive to kind of practice a little bit of what we preached here, perhaps, we don't think we preach, but as we try to think about some of the big questions we maybe get uncomfortable asking or how we might serve our neighbor, Peter and I will do our best with those of you who would like to join us to continue to let the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set them up another round, I'll set them up another round, I'll set them up another round. One more round won't get me down. And I said, honey, I don't care what the people are thinking.